From CAFE, welcome to CAFE Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
How are you, Ann? How was your Memorial Day?
Oh, it was lovely. How was yours?
It was good. We had good weather. We did some grilling.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, as people do.
It's such a strange world. You know, my reaction on Memorial Day was almost like, I couldn't believe it was here, first of all. And then it felt a little surreal, right? I mean, it feels different than obviously it usually does. But we had a really nice day just hanging around as a family. But yeah.
Well, it's a solemn holiday, which some people forget. And obviously much more solemn now as we approach almost 100,000 deaths. So we have a lot of things to talk about. But one thing that I wanted to start with, and you know, we've been talking over the last few days about this. There are a lot of things to be upset at the President of the United States about. And some things are worse than other things. For example, how he's handled the pandemic. But something that's made me sort of more mad than almost anything else, even though it's not the worst thing he's ever done, but something about it violates sort of every principle that you and I hold dear in the criminal justice system. And that, and especially given that he chafes at people doing this kind of thing to him, you know, engaging in conspiracy theories and accusing him, he says falsely. He has repeatedly accused, with the biggest megaphone in the world, as I often say, MSNBC host Joe Scarborough of killing a former staffer, or essentially saying that it should be investigated, with no basis, with no facts, with no evidence whatsoever. I mean, he tweeted a few days ago, when will they open a cold case on the psycho Joe Scarborough matter in Florida? Did he get away with murder? Some people think so. Why did he leave Congress so quietly and quickly? Isn't it obvious? And he's done it up until this morning. We're taping on Tuesday morning, the day after Memorial Day, bringing, you know, all sorts of attention, not just to Joe Scarborough, who's a public figure without any basis, but also to the family of the young staffer who died, I think, something like 20 years ago. You know, I'm speaking about it calmly right now, but it makes my blood boil that you have the sitting president of the United States engaging in this. By the way, not even against somebody he's running against, but somebody who criticizes him on television.
Right. And remember, they used to be close and then they had a falling out. And so it's sort of, it's been this ongoing war with the president attacking both Joe Scarborough and his now wife, Mika, who's his co-host on MSNBC. The thing I would say to that is that one of the things that infuriates me is that it is pure conspiracy theory. It's not just that there's no evidence. There's evidence to the contrary, right? And so you go back and you look at it, which, I mean, it's absurd that we have to do this, but basically it's a tragic death of a 28-year-old woman who had an unknown heart issue, underlying heart condition that was unknown. Scarborough wasn't even in his Florida office at the time. He was in D.C. She was in Florida. And it was a great tragedy and a deep sadness. But the medical examiner looked at it and basically they found that she had this underlying condition that no one knew about. And so it's like the evidence is actually to the contrary. So what Trump is doing is what he always does, where he says, some people say, right? Like he sort of is saying, well, it's not,
yeah,
I'm
that
not
means
the one
nobody.
Exactly. That means nobody else thinks it, but it's a way for him to like throw out a conspiracy without personally saying, well, I think, which would sound crazy. It's like, oh, there's all these other people who think this. And then he keeps tweeting about it and he's doing it to create this sort of idea that there's something there that then needs to be investigated and to sort of, you know, again, it's like he wants to investigate Joe Biden. He wants to investigate Joe Scarborough. He wants to investigate anyone who doesn't fall in line and agree with him. And it is sickening.
For anything. I mean look, this just, you know, by the way, people should just understand that this is not just about Joe Scarborough and this young woman and her family. It means that the President of the United States can take any rumor, gossip, innuendo, or just make something up out of whole cloth about any private citizen in the country and say, hey, maybe you killed somebody. And by the way, this morning was disclosed a heartbreaking letter by the husband of the young woman who died, who basically wrote to Twitter, to Jack Dorsey, the head of Twitter, asking him to delete these tweets. He says a lot of moving things in the letter and about how much pain this has caused him and his family. But one thing he said in particular in the close of the letter is this, quote, I'm asking you to intervene in this instance, because the President of the United States has taken something that does not belong to him, the memory of my dead wife, and perverted it for perceived political gain. End quote.
Yeah, you couldn't say it better than that.
So, you know, maybe we can talk in future episodes about the nature of what recourse a family has, or recourse that Joe Scarborough has,
and Twitter,
or what
frankly,
Twitter
I think
should
it's,
do.
Yeah, it's
what
the
responsibility is. I mean, you and I were discussing before we turned the record button on. If you and I were alleging that someone had committed a homicide and they should be investigated repeatedly over and over again without any basis, I wonder how Twitter would treat us.
Yeah, not well. Not well. And look, this is worth a longer conversation, but it's they have made a decision to allow the president, because he is the president of the United States, to have this microphone largely unchecked. And I think, you know, and we've even talked about this in the context of the president's pandemic briefings, which frankly, a number of the cable networks stopped showing because it was really, there were a lot of falsehoods. It was spreading misinformation, and it felt like a re-election campaign stump rally versus an actual pandemic briefing with information that's important for Americans. So I do think like we have not scrutinized carefully enough, and this historically will be a big issue, the role of the media in giving this bullhorn to the president to spread falsehoods. And obviously the president, you're right, has the biggest bullhorn in the country, but there's a line that gets crossed when it's misinformation and it's falsehood and it's dealing in conspiracy theories that frankly have repercussions for people and their families and are dangerous. And so, you know, and look, by the way, this is straight out of the textbook of authoritarian regimes, too. It's not like, you know, we can say we haven't seen it here, but it's not like the world hasn't seen this kind of conduct. And so how we respond to it, I think, is a really important question, and what processes are in place. So, you know, this is,
I'm
going to
use your phrase. I always refer to the megaphone that Trump has, but bullhorn is much more appropriate. Emphasis on bull. Should we go on to what I think is, other than the pandemic, and it's obviously related to the pandemic, the most important story in the country, and that is how this election is going to unfold.
Yes.
And will people be able to vote in a way that keeps them safe and that maximizes participation? And there are a lot of states we're seeing activity in, and we'll discuss Michigan and Nevada in a second. But boy, I worry a little bit that some of this information and some of this news is not getting as much attention as it might, because rightly people are worried about the actual pandemic. And if we're going to make sure that voting happens in a good way and in an open way, with everyone being able to vote safely, you can't wait till October to think about it. And you can't wait till October to fight about it in court. It's got to happen now, right? So I think right after we taped, I talked about this a little bit maybe on Stay Tuned, but right after we taped last week, Trump started doing this crazy tweeting. We're talking about Twitter again. This time not about Joe Scarborough, but about Michigan and then Nevada. He tweeted, "Michigan sends absentee ballots to 7.7 million people ahead of primaries in the general election. This was done illegally and without authorization by a rogue Secretary of State. I will ask to hold up funding to Michigan if they want to go down this voter fraud path." Multiple things wrong with that tweet. He later actually had to amend that tweet because ballots weren't sent. Applications for ballots were sent. But he stood by everything else he said, including that this was done illegally and without authorization by a rogue Secretary of State. Totally false.
Totally false. Totally false. And actually, you know who authorized money to go out for this? Basically, the United States Congress, the CARES Act, the first stimulus bill basically
went
out.
Money for election purposes, right?
Exactly. And so in some ways, the president authorized it. At least Congress authorized it, and the president signed the law. One thing I think is really worth noting is that this is a fight about access to voting for all Americans, Democrat, Republican, and the idea that in a pandemic, secretaries of state are working now to make sure that people have the ability to vote if it's not safe to go in person. And look, we saw Wisconsin. We all read articles about how there were coronavirus cases that were traced back to that election where people were outside for the primary and you saw those long lines, people close together. And basically, I think you will have huge voter suppression from the pandemic if you do not allow people to vote by mail. And so what the states, both Democratic and Republican, are doing, and so in Nevada, there's a Republican Secretary of State declared the primary a nearly all-mail election and has sent ballots to all registered voters. I mean, this is what people are doing just to basically be able to say, like, you don't have to go in person if you have concerns about your health. And so the president, you know, making false statements and railing against it, like, says to me, and by the way, we should also talk for a minute about which states he's picking, which seem to me to be battleground states or states in which I think he's concerned about the election for himself personally, as opposed to just any state. it really raises this huge issue of access to voting. And, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of speculation, we should talk about this a little bit, but there's a lot of speculation about sort of what comes next. And the president coming out so early and so strong against even the telling people that there are absentee ballots. Like,
I think there's a couple of things going on here. I want to go back to Michigan again for a second, just to make the point that this is what people want of both parties. You know, part of the reason that the Secretary of State of Michigan was authorized to do this is that there was a vote in 2018 by the people of Michigan to do what? To amend their constitution to allow no excuse voting by mail. And it was an overwhelming landslide. According to the New York Times, 66.8% of people voted for mail balloting versus 33.2% who were opposed. And the effect that it's had on voting, again, according to the New York Times, is, to use your word, extraordinary. They had local elections on May 5th. 99% of voters used absentee ballots, which is not surprising given the pandemic. That increased turnout to 25% from an average of 12% in the last 9 May local elections. So you have a pandemic, people are not allowed to gather, people are scared, they have to wear masks, and they actually doubled the participation in that local election. So people want it and they should get it.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is they are doubling participation in part also because we've talked about this before. Elections can be hard for people to get to the polling place to vote, right? There are tons of reasons why people often, you know, struggle to get there, particularly if it's one single day of voting. And I think this is what the president is afraid of, which is that more people vote. He's afraid that in some swing states, that means that he will not be reelected. But again, to your point, I mean, this is Democrat and Republican. There are all Americans who have valid healthcare concerns right now. But particularly, you know, it's just too hard to know. Like, you can't leave this to the last minute. You know, it's not one of those things where you could tell. And I worked in state government for 4 years. You cannot tell. And I oversaw the Division of Elections for a period of time. And then we moved it out to the Secretary of State's office because I felt that it was better there. But, you know, I can tell you from having overseen the Division of Elections for a period of time, there are not a ton of people there. You cannot pivot last minute to get, you know, there are more than 9 million people in the state of New Jersey. Think about even smaller states. Like, it's just impossible to get this kind of scale if people need absentee ballots last minute. And so it's May, the end of May, about to be June. Now is the time for folks to be doing it. Frankly, now is the time. It reminded me that I need to apply for an absentee ballot in New York State. I have not done that, right?
Well, it makes me wonder if something different is going on. I wrote about this last week. It's not just that he wants to prevent absentee balloting, because it's not clear to me that that favors Democrats over Republicans at all. And many Republicans don't think that that's the case. But the other thing he's doing is laying the foundation to claim that any loss is illegitimate because it must be fake.
I think that's number one of what's happening here, because I agree with you.
The West Virginia Secretary of State, a Republican, also sent applications to all 1.2 million registered voters in his state.
And so did Iowa, Georgia, Nebraska, all Republican.
Right. And the West Virginia Secretary of State said, look, it's a matter of what? Quote, fundamental fairness, end quote. I don't know what the evidence is that this helps Democrats, although Trump seems to take that as an article of faith.
Yeah, I actually don't think that that's the case. I think, you know, again, I'm not sure why he thinks that, but I think that there are plenty of Republican voters who and Democratic voters who basically would prefer to vote by mail. And so I think your second point is probably the more important one, which what this does is give the president the ability to basically say the election was not legitimate and I'm not going to listen to the outcome if he loses. And we talk about this sometimes, and it really is the worst case scenario, but I think it's so important to call it what it is, because I think you're right that the idea is to delegitimize the election, that there's fraud, that there's cheating going on. So if he loses, he can say, well, people have cheated. I'm going to sue. I'm going to go to the Supreme Court and ask the Supreme Court to invalidate the election. And I definitely think you're right, because I agree. The evidence is not so clear. Also, let's just talk about the CARES Act for a minute. The money went out for this specific purpose, right? I mean, it didn't specify mail-in ballots. It basically specified that the money could go out. The money is basically intended to help states prepare for an election where coronavirus might otherwise discourage many voters from casting a ballot. And so the idea is to respond to the unique circumstances right now. And so, you know, the president talked a lot also in these tweets about trying to get the money back, or basically trying to stop the money from flowing. first of all, the money has already largely gone out to all the states. And, you know, second of all, the states are using it exactly for the purposes for which it's intended. So it's all sort of bravado in some ways, right? I don't think the president has a legal basis to stand on. I don't think he is going to make any actions to take money back. There would be no legal basis for it. But it's, again, like him throwing his weight around to say something corrupt is happening. Look at these places. And it is really troubling. And this is, I think, just the beginning of how much we're going to see this, the president tweeting about elections.
Yeah, so we should talk about the threat and this little debate that's going on where he said he likes to do this, right? He'd like to do it with Ukraine. He likes to do it with other folks. And he's doing it here with Michigan and potentially other states. I mean, he's walked it back a little bit, saying, look, I'm going to see. But he loves to make the threat. And so people have discussed whether or not that's a violation of the Constitution. Professor Vladek, who's been on the Stay Tuned podcast, suggested it's a violation of the spending clause because the federal government cannot coerce states through threats related to spending. There has been this discussion of a statute that I was not familiar with, maybe you were, 18 U.S.C. Section 598, which says, quote, whoever uses any part of any appropriation made by Congress for the purpose of interfering with, restraining, or coercing any individual in the exercise of his right to vote at any election shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 1 year or both. I don't know if you carry through on the threat, if that qualifies. Waldschaub identified the statute and some other people have been talking about it. I think once again, this conversation, just like during the case of impeachment, when we're talking about whether or not there's a technical violation of a particular statute, that's an important question. But I think it misses the point.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that's the question.
It's an abuse of power.
Yeah,
the question
exactly.
Is it an abuse of power?
Yes,
and,
exactly.
And is look, it a disgusting abuse of power? And it is.
And the president is, what he's going to do is threaten it and then not do it. But he's threatening it in a way to try to get people to change their, he's one, putting a stake in the ground so he can say it's not a legitimate election. And two, you know, and bullies do this all the time. Like they say something and they're sort of putting others on notice. So Republican secretaries of state who are about to send out applications or absentee ballots may think twice about it because they're going to go crosswise to the president. And so he's doing what he wants to do without actually getting to the point where I think he would commit that crime. Look, if he did withhold the funds, there are tons of legal challenges. I think the president would lose. I don't have any question on that legal grounds, but I don't think he's going to actually withhold it. It's the threat that he wants to have out there because the threat accomplishes his multiple goals. Now, one thing to say also is that, and I do think you're right to bring up the parallels to Ukraine and the way that the president behaves, because also at play here, Steve Vladek and others, who's a University of Texas law professor, and others have talked about the Impoundment Control Act, which we'll remember Congress had authorized money to go to Ukraine for their protection, and then the president had put a hold on it. And then you have the Government Accountability Office, a bipartisan government agency, had said that the president violated the Impoundment Control Act by withholding the funds for Ukraine because Congress had legitimately authorized them. Here, you would have the exact same situation. Congress puts money out under the CARES Act. It's for the exact purpose to basically help states adapt their elections during a global pandemic, which threatens people's health and safety. And so, you know, it's just, there is just a constant theme here of the president basically abusing his power. And so, again, I mean, I think you and I are going to talk about elections a lot between now and November because every week, and we should just be really focused on making sure people see what is happening because some of it, there is so much happening. It feels like when I first read the Michigan and Nevada tweets, I was like, ugh, it's just the normal bluster, threatening, bullying behavior. And the more I thought about it, the more I think that, like, this is one of the core things we have to be on the lookout for. And frankly, it's hard to push back on in the midst of a global pandemic where the president is sort of, he's out trying to control and define the narrative. And part of that is
he's gotten away
about
with
election
it.
Fraud. Yes, exactly.
He's gotten away with it. You know, other people have pointed out some testimony during the impeachment case, including from Professor Pam Carlin, who essentially said, this is a direct quote, which is not quite on point, but it's not far off. Quote, what would you think if when your governor asked the federal government for the disaster assistance that Congress has provided, the president responded, I would like you to do us a favor. I'll send the disaster relief once you brand my opponent a criminal, end quote. She warned about this kind of conduct and this kind of behavior, which is analogous to what happened in Ukraine. And the president thinks it's totally fine. Maybe he won't ultimately do it, but he'll threaten it, and it's fine. And by the way, you have defenders of the president, including another professor, John Turley, who's sometimes critical of the president, but does an interesting job defending the president by making straw man arguments, suggesting that everyone attacked Trump's tweet as being a criminal act. And nobody did that. And we don't have to bore people with these Twitter threads that you and I read and maybe obsess over. But the argument that people are making is not that the tweet itself that the president sent is evidence of a crime. It is a contemplation of an abuse of power at a minimum, and possibly, depending on what circumstances are present and the way in which he does it and what proof could be developed, might be a crime.
Yeah. I mean, I think Turley, I don't know what's going on with him, but I would say that his legal arguments are not strong in any way. And I you know, I didn't follow him closely enough, but I did follow this debate fairly closely. And he makes this, you know, he sort of writes, quote, once again, the statement, meaning the president's statement, could be entirely legal if the funds were discretionary or Trump asked for the restrictions from Congress. Such things appear to matter little. Simply declaring a tweet a crime is instantly accepted and repeated on networks like CNN and MSNBC. And he's basically arguing, like, people are quick to basically say the president's tweet is a crime. What he's missing is that he's missing so many points there. But basically, you know, nobody's saying it's a crime. People are saying if the president were to follow through on it, it's potentially a crime, which is how all crimes are uncovered, which is someone says or does something. You don't know. You don't have all the elements of the crime. You don't need all the elements of a crime to move forward. You just need to begin an investigation. And so if you sort of took Turley's argument to the logical sort of extreme, it basically means the president can tweet anything, even if it's, you know, criminal, because there are pieces that are missing to prove the elements of those crimes in some ways. And so, like,
yeah, you got to be able to criticize it when it's happening. You don't wait. It seems by Turley's logic, look, he sends the tweet, everyone should applaud it or roll their eyes or ignore it. And then when he follows through, then later people can have something to say about it. But, you know, it might be nice to discourage the president from committing a bad act, which, by the way, sometimes happens because there's an uproar and he walks his suggestion back, which is exactly the purpose of discussion.
Yes. And the whole purpose of the president's tweets, I don't want to attribute why he's doing it exactly, but, like, they can feel very threatening in nature. Like, those, if I'm the Secretary of State of Michigan or Nevada, I read that and I think the president is going to try to claw back millions of dollars and, or, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars we just got in federal aid under the CARES Act. And so that's the intention. So the words do matter and it's worth scrutinizing. And it's really important to basically say, like, look, if he does this, that's a violation of the Impoundment Control Act. It might be suppression of voter rights. There might be litigation. And that's part of what, you know, the president doesn't have to tweet about these things, but when he walks into the arena, those kinds of responses are appropriate. And by the way, can I tell you my favorite response to Jonathan Turley's argument came from Joe Patrice in Above the Law, which is a blog. He goes through, I have to be honest, he goes through in a lot of very strong analysis how it would work. But my favorite quote, as the dude informs Walter Sobchak, quote, "This isn't a First Amendment thing, man," close quote. And then Patrice goes on to say, "No one, absolutely no one, suggested that Trump's tweets were crimes. They explained that the policy Trump described would be either unauthorized or an illegal act. Turley should be ashamed of himself for trying to jam this square peg in that round hole." So it's a great reference to the Big Lebowski movie. And, you know, also a good reminder that you can't just scream First Amendment, First Amendment. And that First Amendment gives you the right to say things. It doesn't give you the right to avoid scrutiny for saying them.
You can scream that in a crowded theater, though, right? You can scream First Amendment in a crowded theater, I think.
Right.
I remember that from law school.
You can't scream fire in a crowded theater.
Yes, I know.
But you could scream things about Donald Trump. First of all, no one's going to a crowded theater.
That's
so
true.
There's a long time before.
Although drive-thrus are coming back. I can't wait.
Yeah, I love them. The last time I saw a drive-thru movie was in upstate New York many, many, many years ago, The Karate Kid.
Oh. I think I saw one of the Jaws
movies. That's kind of a non sequitur, but yeah.
There was a huge drive-in movie theater like a mile from where I lived in Eatontown, New Jersey, right next to the Monmouth Mall.
I know it well.
Which is where I learned about life, I guess.
I know, you know, people know won't understand it, but like I grew up right near the East Brunswick Mall. So like, you know,
yeah, we were mall kids.
Yeah, people joke about what exit on the Turnpike or Parkway, but really it's like, what was your mall? Is the right question.
Well, I was exit 105.
Yeah.
Should we move on to a story that we thought would be long gone from the headlines?
Yes.
The continuing saga of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. I don't know how much people appreciate who are non-lawyers, how utterly bonkers this case has become. Whatever side you're on, whatever you think.
That's the right, yeah.
Yeah, look, whatever you think about his guilt or innocence or what the FBI did, just for lawyers who have practiced criminal law, procedurally, the back and forth that's happened is just out of control, crazy, bonkers.
Yeah, it's unprecedented. I've never seen anything like it.
So each thing that we examine, and other people have said this, each new twist and turn, you can say, well, that's crazy. How is that allowed to happen? No one's ever seen that before. It's in the context of the three prior things in the case also being crazy and unprecedented and you've never seen before. Can I just recount them and then we'll go through them?
Please.
It's bonkers that you have a national security advisor who lied to the vice president and lied to the FBI. It's then bonkers, sort of, but not as much, that someone like that was charged. Then the guy pleads. It's then truly bonkers, as we've been discussing, that the government, after a guilty plea and an affirmation of the guilty plea, moves to dismiss its own case when it's already won its case. That's bonkers. Then it's kind of not out of control, but then it's kind of unprecedented for the judge, in this case, Judge Emmett Sullivan, not to grant the motion to dismiss right away, but to ask for an amicus brief and to appoint a retired judge to look into the issue. Then it's crazy bonkers, and this we'll talk about, what happened last week, that the defendant's lawyers, Michael Flynn's lawyers, before waiting for the district judge to make up his mind, goes to the appellate court and seeks what's called a mandamus, and we'll explain what that is, to force the judge to give them what they want. And then for the appeals court to entertain that and ask basically the judge to show cause, you know, why he shouldn't. And then for the judge, Emmett Sullivan, to hire his own lawyer, Beth Wilkinson. A series of crazy things happening in this case.
I was trying to think what you could call this podcast. It's like a bonkers-a-rama. There's like, it is beyond.
We could call it extraordinary.
It is. And actually, we're going to get to use extraordinary in a legal sentence in a minute when we talk about the mandamus. Because by definition, a mandamus is an extraordinary remedy.
I ticked through a lot of different things. When last we joined you guys, or I guess when you guys joined us, the district court had gone through the trouble of appointing former Judge John Gleason to write a brief for the court to take the opposite side of what the government said in the motion to dismiss and to consider the question of whether or not Michael Flynn could be held in contempt. Since then, the next thing that happened is the defense has gone to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, not even waiting for a decision.
And Preet, we had a listener question from Gail from Chicago. She's a civil litigator and attorney, and she's fascinated by the Flynn case. And she basically was asking about this exact thing, which is, you know, Flynn makes this filing and asks the appellate court to intervene in hopes of stopping Judge Sullivan from, you know, holding these hearings, having the amicus briefs come in and Judge Gleason be involved. And basically, she wants to understand, like, how does the appellate court have jurisdiction to do this? Like, how do they have the authority? And so it's worth just talking about, you know, there are a couple of decision points here. I mean, one, and you and I have talked a lot about Judge Sullivan, there was an interesting sort of discussion that came out last week, and it was basically saying, you know, Judge Sullivan should have just denied Michael Flynn's motion, right? Basically arguing, instead of doing this whole circus and all these hearings, he basically should have just said no, because under the federal rules of criminal procedure, the judge has a role that's written into those rules, which is to basically make decisions in the public interest. And they note, which is correct, and I think a lot of people may not understand this, but it's important to know, judges can even turn down guilty pleas. So someone can come into court, the prosecutor and the defense lawyer can say, we want this person to plead guilty. And the judge can say no. And there are lots of reasons why the judge can say no. So their argument was Sullivan should have just cut it off and said no. He didn't. As you and I both know, he's created this process. He's allowing folks to write briefs to explain.
Can I just interject for 1 second? Because I don't know that I buy the argument. And I have, although I don't have sympathy for Michael Flynn in this case, I don't have sympathy for the government's position in this case. I do have sympathy for the general principle and legal rule that a judge has very, very, very limited ability to second guess, and we'll talk about this case in a minute, to second guess the executive branch's decision to prosecute or not prosecute somebody. And it's true that there's a rule and it exists and there's some role and there can be an inquiry, but it might surprise some people. I am very sympathetic to the idea that, you know, maybe given my past, that judges should not be stepping into the shoes of prosecutors and saying, you know what, sorry, you should be prosecuting this person, and I'm going to go out of my way to make sure that you do, even if you have reason to believe that it's no longer in the interest of justice. Now here, this is one of those examples of a thing where the government does something terrible.
But it's not absolute. It's not absolute. And I just want to stop you there.
Because I want to make it clear that it's very, very limited. And to the extent people are saying, like, very sort of casually, oh, yeah, of course, the judge can just deny the motion. That is not a small thing to do.
No, it is not a small thing to do. And the judge would have to have a basis or an articulable basis in the public interest to be able to do it. And here, I actually think he would have to make the record. And so this is why I think he gets to the hearing. He needs to basically be able to make the record that something wrong is happening, right? That the government's interest in dismissing it is actually not valid and is based on politics or something else. So I fundamentally think that ultimately the government has the first right to decide what cases are and are not in the public interest. But it is really important to remember the judge is a check on that. And they the first draft of the rules related to the judge's role did not include that judicial check. The second and final draft that the Supreme Court put out did include that. And
yes,
so
no, it's obviously the rule has really to have important. Some purpose.
Yes, exactly.
But on either side, let me just say this. For people who say
it's a
casually,
debatable issue, yeah, right?
But
in my,
people
in
on the
mind.
One hand who say it's very easy and casual who say, yeah, just deny the motion. If you don't like it, judge, you can force, you know, the case to go to sentencing. I don't love that view. I also don't love the view in the other direction, which is the judge has no role at all to play and shouldn't be doing anything and shouldn't be asking any questions, because what would be the reason for that rule that says you need the court's permission to dismiss a case? But going back to the listener's question, you know, what jurisdiction does the appellate court have? I mean, generally speaking, the circuit court does not have jurisdiction. There's not been a decision yet to appeal from. So some of the lay reporting that you see is getting it wrong. It's not an appeal. They're seeking something that's called a writ for mandamus, which is, again, exceedingly rare, extremely uncommon, very infrequently granted, where you're essentially calling on the power of a circuit court to intervene at some juncture to prevent a district court from doing something that is terrible and bad in the law. My only experience with it, we discussed this over the week, was when I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office as a young prosecutor. There was a judge in our district who said that he was going to tell the jury about the mandatory minimum sentence in a child pornography case. Generally speaking, the rules are that jurors
don't tell a jury.
Yeah, jurors don't about are sentencing. Not supposed to concern themselves with sentencing, just guilt or not guilt. That, you know, you have two choices. And we sought mandamus. So there's no appeal. We went to the Second Circuit and said, you need to mandate the district judge to do X or Y. And they did.
And just to be really clear on that, if a judge instructed the jury, the likelihood of that being overturned on appeal, in my view, is 100%, right? Because it's a very long-standing rule,
yeah, but,
or
but
let's
say
99%.
If there's an acquittal, there's no appeal.
Exactly,
That's why we have to go
exactly,
up.
Exactly, right. I just want people to understand that it's not just something that could be fought out on appeal. But here, you're right. If you know you got an acquittal, you have a problem, and you can't obviously, you know, the government cannot appeal an acquittal. And so this becomes a critical issue. The only time I've ever seen mandamus done, and so people should understand, you and I practiced for a long time, and you've seen it once. I was not involved in it, but I saw it happen in New Jersey in the federal prosecution of a lawyer named Paul Berggren, who was ultimately convicted of murder. He was representing clients. Witnesses were killed. He was prosecuted. He was charged and prosecuted for the murder of a number of individuals. And the trial judge, Judge Martini in Newark, basically, I can't remember exactly what he was doing with the evidence, but he made a decision that the U.S. Attorney's Office, the government, felt very strongly was the wrong decision and would have completely changed the outcome of their case. And like the situation you just addressed, if there was an acquittal, there could be no appeal. And so they felt so strongly, they went to the Third Circuit on it. The Third Circuit reversed the trial judge and the case went back to go to trial. These are really, really rare. And so I've never done one. I've only seen one in my whole career. And so the other point that I think is worth making here is when you and I are talking about the use of mandamus, we're talking about it in situations where but for this happening, but for the sort of mandamus being brought, there's going to be an outcome where you're not going to get a second bite of the apple. Like, there's a real possibility there's no other chance to litigate an issue. Here, I don't see that. I mean, Michael Flynn has pled guilty. The judge would be basically holding these hearings, then making a sentencing decision that could be appealed. So,
right, exactly. And probably he would get bail pending appeal, too.
Right. So I found it really interesting that the circuit court basically is entertaining this motion. It may be that they want to just have it sort of briefed, you know, both sides are submitting briefs, so they have the full arguments from both sides. But it is to me, this is the kind of thing where what I would have expected a circuit court to have done is to basically say, mandamus is an extraordinary remedy. It's used only in emergency circumstances. And here, there can be a process. We should let the normal court process play out. There'll be hearings. There'll be and look.
That's
here's
not
the other
what happened
crazy
here.
Thing. Here's the crazy thing. I still think what you think, Preet, that the judge was going to extract some pain, but ultimately was going to allow the government to basically withdraw the case. Now there's a separate question as to Flynn and perjury, but I think the judge ultimately was probably going to go in Flynn's favor. So I think this is
a very risky move. I think it, as I've been saying, it's maybe not a bad outcome in this case to deny the motion to dismiss, but I think it's a bad result for law enforcement generally. And there are other, you can change the facts of the case, and you could have, you know, a rogue judge in other circumstances basically, you know, denying government's motions to dismiss that are actually done in good faith. That, you know, it really is, you know, up to the government to decide these things. Can we talk about something that I've been dying to discuss since I read about the case?
Yes.
That
always.
Flynn's lawyers rely on heavily to make their point that, you know, you really can't second guess what the government is doing here. And the reason I want to discuss the case is not just because of the holding, but I giggled like a little boy when I saw the name of the case.
Oh, yeah, me too.
It's United States v. Fokker Services.
Isn't there a movie, Meet the Fokkers?
So I looked it up to see. So this is United States v. Fokker Services, F-O-K-K-E-R. Meet the Fokkers is different. It's F-O-C-K-E-R.
Okay.
But I was anticipating with great delight and childhood idiocy discussing with you, Anne, U.S. v. Fokker Services.
You know, Preet, this is a podcast where we've already talked about The Big Lebowski. Now we've talked about Meet the Fokkers. It's like movie trivia night at the legal podcast.
All right, so let me be serious for a moment about the case. I don't know if I mentioned the name. It's United States v. Fokker Services. And it stands for the proposition. It stands for various propositions. The sentence that probably Flynn's lawyers like the most is, or the couple of sentences, is the following. Quote, the Constitution allocates primacy in criminal charging decisions to the executive branch. The executive's charging authority embraces decisions about whether to initiate charges, whom to prosecute, which charges to bring, and whether to dismiss charges once brought. It has long been settled that the judiciary generally lacks authority to second-guess those executive determinations, much less to impose its own charging preferences. So that's a broad statement that is consistent with what we've been talking about here, that as a general matter, and in almost all cases, the prosecutors decide when to bring a case, and they also decide when not to bring a case and whether to dismiss a case in the interests of justice. And usually that's done in good faith. The problem here, and what's making it difficult here, is there's a lot to suggest it's not being done in good faith, and it's special treatment for someone who's associated with the president, and career prosecutors have been overruled in a way that kind of stinks to high heaven. But the general principle here that they're relying upon is that you don't second guess the government. So in U.S. v. Fokker Services, that was a case in which the government had a prosecution of a company, and rather than doing a full bore prosecution, decided to engage in a deferred prosecution agreement, which means if the company behaves for a period of time, then the charges go away. In order for that to work, they needed the judge to impose an order excluding time from the speedy trial clock. In other words, the government wouldn't have to go immediately to trial.
They wanted to hit pause.
Yeah, hit pause with the DPA, the Deferred Prosecution Agreement. The judge didn't like the charging decision. The judge thought the government was being too lenient and that individuals were not being prosecuted. So the judge denied the pause. And that was the issue being appealed in United States v. Fokker. And the court said, you know, really, that's not a good basis on which to do that. You can't second guess the government. That's what was going on in that case. The Flynn lawyers rely on very, very heavily in their brief.
Right. And a lot of legal scholars have pointed out, and I think it's really persuasive to me personally, that one of the differences with Fokker and the current situation is that in that prior case, it related to something, there had been no conviction. It was what we would call sort of in the pretrial stages. It was before the case had gone to trial. And the idea was, let's defer any prosecution. The government is basically saying, let's hit pause. And the defense agrees. And it's likely that the charges may be dismissed if deferred prosecution agreement, if the terms of that agreement are successfully completed. But that's at the beginning of sort of this process that people go through in the criminal justice system versus here when Flynn has pled guilty. I would usually say pleaded, but for you today, Preet, I'm going to say pled. He's pled guilty. It's moved on. And now it's a sentencing point. And so it is different in my view. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what the circuit does on this. But this is not apples to apples. This is a little apples to oranges because this is at a different point in time.
I think it's apples to cantaloupes.
Yeah, I love cantaloupe. I like apples too. But the thing here is, so there is a big difference between these cases, and people should understand who aren't lawyers. This is exactly what courts do, where they say, okay, we have this one rule here, but it's a different circumstance. Should that rule apply here in this other circumstance? To me, I keep going back to the circuit court asked the parties to brief what role Fokker should play in this, that case, you know, is it controlling? Does that mean that the government gets full say? But the other thing they asked them to brief was Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 48A, which is the rule, as we know, that says for dismissals, subpart A is by the government may, with leave of court, dismiss an indictment, information, or complaint. And it also says the government may not dismiss the prosecution during trial without the defendant's consent. So basically, the question really then comes to, and they're going to brief this, what does leave of the court mean? What's the standard? There is precedent saying the judge has a role to play in whether or not the dismissal is in the public interest. And for me, ultimately, just to point this out, and I would love your thoughts on this, forget the Flynn case for a second. And I know this case is so strange, you could argue that it's a one-off and that any precedent by the D.C. Circuit isn't controlling in other cases because this is so unusual. But I personally say, like, forget Flynn for a second. You have a situation where a judge is about to hold, has basically not said yes or no to a motion. The motion is pending. They're about to hold hearings to decide whether it is in the public interest, right? And whether, basically, and ask for a full vetting of the issues from both sides. Since the government has changed its position, the judge is saying, I want to hear the contrary argument to that. It is unusual, and we've talked about this. Like, Judge Sullivan has, you know, he definitely, I don't know if I want to call him a maverick, but he definitely is sort of beat to his own drummer in some of the ways he's made decisions. But do you, as a circuit court, does that circuit court want to say, oh no, we're gonna just require that the judge accept this motion? That to me feels like you're writing out of that Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure with leave of court. You're basically saying there is no process. I don't know.
You pointed out a number of differences between the Fokker case and the Flynn case. First, that one was pre-conviction, the other is post-conviction. And then you're referring to Rule 48. In the Fokker case, there was no Rule 48 invoked whatsoever. It wasn't even at play in that case. And then to me, the most important distinction, perhaps, is that in the Fokker case, there was a decision that was then appealed. Here, Judge Sullivan hasn't entered a decision yet. As we have been saying, our prediction was at the end of the day, after making some factual record, he probably still would grant the motion. What they're trying to do here is an end run around the district court.
That we should maybe talk about the day, why they want yeah, that. Yeah.
Maybe at the end of the day, you know, they could appeal and get what they want. But the idea that this gambit would work would mean kind of that in every circumstance where a judge under Rule 48A is just making some inquiry and asking some questions can be short-circuited in what is demanded and required under Rule 48A. Otherwise, what's the point of it?
Yeah, right? And how does the judge figure out good faith? Right, completely. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's at a different stage. It's after you have the conviction and nothing has happened yet that you can complain about other than they want to avoid the embarrassment of having the judge make a factual inquiry and have some friends of the court briefs that show that the motion to dismiss the Flynn case is grounded in special treatment and politics and has no good basis. And they don't want that. And they want to avoid that. They accuse the judge of wanting to sort of revel in the limelight. By the way, the other thing they're doing is asking for the disqualification of the judge. That's one of the other things being sought in the circuit court, which is dangerous because if the judge is not disqualified, you know, he's going to be that much more pissed, as they say.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, usually the judges are not, at least in the Judge Martini case with Paul Berggren, he was not removed. They tried the case in front of him and the case just went forward. I hate to be cynical, but I sort of feel very strongly that this is this is an attempt to do exactly what you just said, which is to cut off that hearing and to cut off the public sort of embarrassment. And also, it seems clear to me that there's a narrative that's moving in the president's reelection, which is, you know, Flynn is innocent. He was framed. This was all partisan, the entire Russia 2016 thing. It's sort of rewriting history, right? And a hearing held by Judge Sullivan would question that, their ability, I think, very strongly to rewrite history, or at least it would make a record. And right now, the record is the DOJ record, and that's what they want it to be. And so, you know, I think that the circuit court has to be really careful here. I mean, you and I have talked just a little bit amongst ourselves that the three circuit court judges are Karen Henderson. She was a George Herbert Walker Bush appointment. Robert Wilkins, he was a Barack Obama appointment. And then Naomi Rao, she was a Donald Trump appointment. She's by far, I think, the most, I don't know if I want to say political, but she feels the most sort of, she's very loyal to Trump. I think she's very likely to, she will be
there's
the
a lot
extreme.
Of controversy about her nomination.
Yes, yes.
And a lot of Democratic opposition to her nomination. The other weird thing here, but maybe it's just weird for people like us who are lawyers and follow these things. It is weird. I'm not saying good or bad, but it is weird that when the circuit court, you know, says to the judge, Emmett Sullivan, you got to show us why what you're doing is okay. He's not doing it with his own pen. He himself, the court itself, hired a lawyer, very prominent, distinguished, excellent lawyer, Beth Wilkinson, who, among other things, prosecuted Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh, represented Justice Kavanaugh amid the allegation relating to Christine Blasey Ford. She's represented Hillary Clinton staffers, so she's represented people on both sides of the aisle in very prominent cases in D.C. for many years. A little odd, right, for the court to hire its own lawyer?
Okay, so yes and no. You know, you said it up front that everything about this case is bonkers. And so I agree with that. This is also a little bonkers. But I will say this, you know, in New Jersey, when I was AG, there were times where we appointed lawyers for the Supreme Court, or this, it wasn't in this circumstance where a judge is being asked by another court to explain their reasoning, but it's not unprecedented for judges and courts to have lawyers. So I just want to say that, first of all, like the sort of immediate reaction here was, oh, that never happens. It does happen. And it often happens to basically have a voice for whether it's a court or a judge, but basically it's not never. And so I just want to be clear that I think that the sort of, if you read legal Twitter, you'd think that this never happens. And in my experience, I definitely have signed off on maybe not more than 10, but maybe 5 or 10. So that's one thing to note. The second thing is, this is all weird. And so I went back and forth on this. I mean, my first reaction was Judge Sullivan should write it himself. But my second reaction is that this is a huge institutional issue. If the court basically grants mandamus on this and forces the judge to accept Flynn's motion, I mean, it's almost like the court basically eviscerating itself and really taking away its authority in sentencing matters and in plea matters. And so there's a value in an institutional check and balance in not just having Judge Sullivan, who's obviously hugely invested, he made a decision about the right thing to do, him having some sort of a really high level, top notch lawyer to go back and forth with. I do see that there's value, and there's an institutional reason for the court to want to litigate this to the best of its ability. So is it weird?
Look, yes. It's not cool the way it's proceeding here. So just use the example of the case that I mentioned earlier, the child pornography case that involved Judge Lynch. Judge Lynch didn't tell the jury about the mandatory minimum sentence and then cause the prosecutors to jump up, scream, and then appeal. He understood that it was a potentially controversial thing to which the government might object. So my recollection is he told the parties in advance. He said, look, my intention is to tell the jury. Now I want to know what you think about that. And having been given notice, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York went to the Court of Appeals and sought a mandamus. Here, you know, it's possible that you could have a mandamus situation that is more appropriate if, after engaging in a factual inquiry, Judge Sullivan said, you know what, having heard everything, it is my intention. I'm just saying this is one possibility. It is my intention to deny the motion to dismiss. I don't think you've laid it out. What do you want to do about that? And then I guess maybe you could have a mandamus there, or you could let him do it and then appeal, because as you say, there's really no difference in that circumstance because there's not the same kind of irreparable harm. In the jury situation from my old office, you have a sitting jury. You can't sort of, you know, pause everything for like a month to figure out whether or not the judge is going to be able to do this thing or that thing, et cetera.
Yeah. So I guess my point, and I think, you know, what you just said sort of is making me think even more this way, which is that I think that there's a strong enough institutional reason to be pushing back on this, that it is possible that the federal court, the federal bench in D.C. that is pushing to have outside counsel as much as it is Judge Sullivan. I think obviously they couldn't do it without Judge Sullivan's agreement, but I think that there's a very strong institutional issue at play here. And I'm concerned of what the outcome will be. Again, I would have expected them to have denied the mandamus at this point, not to have ordered briefing. If they, you know, grant the mandamus, I think it's possible we'll see a request to have an en banc review, to have the entire D.C. Circuit hear it. It's just, it's a really strange place to be. And look, Beth Wilkinson is a great lawyer. I do not know her well. I think I met her once. But she's very, very well regarded as, you know, one of the Oklahoma City bombing prosecutors, but also just as somebody who's, she's done plaintiff side work, defense side work. And so the judge has already come to a position, and it's, you're sort of having an outside check on that position and thinking about the best way to argue the institutional requirements of sort of where this is.
Last point on Flynn is, I don't know what to make of this. I don't know if I find it disturbing or maybe people are making too much of it. So finally, last week, the FBI director, Chris Wray, announced that the FBI would conduct an internal review of the investigation into Mr. Flynn. So as we have been discussing for some time, the attorney general appointed a U.S. attorney from another jurisdiction, Jeff Jensen, to do all this. That's why you had the recommendation to dismiss the case against Flynn. That's why we're having all this discussion in the first place. Presumably, the FBI was cooperating with that investigation. So I don't know what to make of this announcement. I don't know if this is to placate the president or what.
I find it troubling.
Looked like he's been, looks like he's been in a kind of a precarious position. I said very positive things about Chris Wray last week. I think he's been keeping his head down and doing a good job. But this is a weird announcement. I'm overusing the word weird.
He is in a precarious position. And so, you know, if he falls out of favor with the president will fire him or try to fire him. And I think he probably thinks he is the best person to sit in that job at this point in time. So there's a line that he has to toe. And we understand from the president that there's no question that the president expects a certain level of loyalty, even from the FBI director. But if you think about this, this is back to 2016. The FBI should have already conducted a review if there was one that should have been conducted. All the evidence that they provided to Jensen, the FBI, obviously, they're the ones who provided it, so they had it. And it looks really political in the lead up to an election, and it brings the FBI. And look, if you had a situation where Wray was saying, look, we should have looked at our internal policies on whether or not we basically confront people with their lies or whatnot, again, that should have been done before the lead up to the election. And even if the FBI wants to do it, thinks that there's something that they missed, there's a way to do it that doesn't put them front and center in the 2020 election. And that's what Chris Wray has done. And so I looked at this and I was really disheartened to see it, because I think it's also possible that he's doing it to get ahead of potential charges that get brought. We've talked about this, but Barr has intimated that they may charge people. Like, it just worries me a lot to basically have Wray doing this. And I don't know why. I don't want to speculate. You know, I'm already speculating too much, but there's something about it that just is not right. And so I don't know why they're doing it. And I think we're going to find out in the months to come, but it's not a good thing. And it's not a good look. Even if they're doing it internally for the right reasons, this is not the time and place to do it.
So there's another case that's back in the news that we've been talking about that got a lot of attention. And that was the killing of Ahmaud Arbery some time ago. And there was a release of that videotape that showed two white men, a father and a son, basically accosting him and then killing him. And then there were multiple district attorneys, as we discussed, who had to recuse themselves and didn't think there was a case to bring until finally one district attorney did. And the new news is that the person who was driving the car and taking the video that became controversial and sensational has now also been arrested. What do you make of that?
Right. So the McMichaels are the father and son. They were charged with murder and aggravated assault in the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. What we've now seen is the guy who took the video was the third man. It was always clear there were three individuals involved. He videotaped the actual murder, which, again, you know, we've talked a little bit about. What's interesting about this individual, William, he goes by Roddy Bryan, is that he's been charged with felony murder. And essentially, he's charged with felony murder, meaning that someone is murdered in the course of the commission of a serious crime, and that being a felony. And here, he's also charged with the felony, which is a criminal attempt at false imprisonment, which is basically holding somebody and not letting them go. And so the allegation is that there was an earlier attempt to detain Arbery before this moment in time when he's shot and killed. And so, you know, you and I have seen a lot of felony murder cases. There's been some sort of questioning of how common is felony murder. It's actually very common to charge it, and it happens a lot. I mean, you know, the sort of classic examples in the midst of a robbery, you might have like the getaway driver. You know, three people agree to do a robbery, two people go into a bank, someone ends up being, you know, they end up shooting and killing one of the bank tellers, and then come out. And even though the getaway driver did not fire the shot, did not even say, go in and kill a bank teller, like didn't have that intent. They intended to do the robbery. They intended to commit that felony. Someone is killed in the commission of that crime. All three can be charged with murder or felony murder. So the getaway driver is charged with felony murder. So we do see it a lot. I mean, I think the question always becomes at trial, the strength of the underlying felony charge. And so here they will litigate, Roddy Bryan will litigate at trial, you know, was he actually falsely imprisoning Arbery before Arbery was murdered? But it's a really important step forward in a case. It's been very clear there were three men who were involved. And so, you know, now it's time for the evidence to come, and the case obviously moves on to motions and trials, and we'll keep following it.
I wonder, I don't know much about what the local practice is in that state, but I wonder if part of the reason to charge Roddy, the videographer, is to put pressure on him to be a witness against the two other men.
Yeah. I mean, this is worth talking about for a minute, that you know, when you try a case, you have to understand what happened. And so there are three people who are involved here and what role each of them played. And it's very important for the jury to understand that when you try a case. And so it's been said many times by trial lawyers far more experienced than me that you have to sort of be able to understand, is that person a defendant, a witness, a victim? Like what place does that individual play? And so it's clear to me that, you know, the government has looked at this and come to the conclusion that the third individual is actually a defendant and sits in that seat at the table. And you're right that it could be to put pressure to ultimately get a cooperation agreement. But it's also, these are decisions prosecutors have to make, because you can't just have someone like that out there where you haven't come to an understanding of, is he a witness? Is he somebody who was involved in the crime? And clearly they came to the conclusion that he was involved in the crime. Now they have to prove that in a court. So Pree, there's some other very important news that we haven't talked about, which is the stop in Utah earlier in May by a Utah Highway Patrol officer of a car. Should
very
we talk about that
stop.
A little?
Yeah. You know, run-of-the-mill police work in Utah. I guess the officer thought that there was a driver who might have been intoxicated. There was an SUV weaving in the left lane on Interstate 15, and he wanted to investigate because it's a good cop. And what did the cop find behind the wheel?
Well, he was expecting to find a drunk driver because the car was going slowly, was driving erratically. And instead, he finds five-year-old Adrian.
Who, five-year-old.
Five-year-old. And by the way,
that five-year-old?
When we said this in front of our five-year-old, his eyes went really wide, like, I didn't know you could do that. Well, you can't, obviously. But the officer questioned Adrian, and Adrian explained that he took his mother's car after getting into a heated argument with her. Adrian asked his mother to buy him a Lamborghini, and when she said no, he took off in her car.
Well,
and he had a plan. He had $3. He was going to California to buy one himself.
By the way, this is in the middle of the pandemic.
Yes, yes.
A Lamborghini costs more or less than $3?
More. More. Right. And what's great is the officer, I mean, he's got a dash camera, so this is all filmed. And basically, you know, the officer doesn't charge the child. He takes the child back home. And because this went viral on Twitter, an actual Lamborghini owner did take Adrian for a ride so he could ride in a Lamborghini. And Adrian offered the driver $3. But he said, I want, and then the kid says, and the driver says, you know, are you trying to buy this car for me for $3? And Adrian responded, no, I want to keep my money, but you can give me the Lamborghini.
That's an entitled kid.
Yeah.
So maybe he will be so focused on getting a Lamborghini. That
with a lot of moxie.
With a lot of moxie, as they say.
With a lot
also,
of moxie.
You know, not so safe. Lock your cars, folks.
Yeah, completely, completely.
And have a good week. I will try to figure out some way next week to again talk about the Fokker case.
or another great movie.
Or another great movie.
Thanks, Preet. Talk to you soon.
Take care, Ann.
Bye.
That's it for this week's Insider Podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Ann Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior audio producer is David Tatasciore. And the cafe team is Matthew Billy, David Curlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Calvin Lord, Noah Azulai, and Jeff Eisenman. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.